the headlines this hour. The capital of Afghanistan becoming the scene of fresh violence. 19 dead, dozens injured as explosions and gunfire shake Kabul. Tehran says it will not settle for anything less than objective guarantees from Washington over its commitments to the Iran nuclear deal. Also in the headlines, Russia hitting another record in its daily COVID deaths despite a nationwide partial lockdown in place to curb the pandemic. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Two explosions followed by gunfire tearing through the capital city of Afghanistan, causing panic and leaving many casualties. A Taliban security official says the attack, just outside of a military hospital in Kabul, has killed at least 19 people and wounded 50 others. So far, there's no word on who is responsible for the violence. The Daesh terrorists have ramped up their attacks across Afghanistan since the Taliban took over in mid-August. The group has targeted mosques and other places with serial bombings, resulting in heavy civilian casualties. Tehran is uncertain whether President Joe Biden can keep his promise of returning the U.S. to the Iran nuclear deal and remaining committed to the agreement. The foreign ministry spokesman says that Iran will settle for nothing less than objective guarantees from the U.S. that it will live up to its commitments. Saif Khatibzadeh says that Biden needs to convince the international community that he will stand by his words and that his signature has any value. In a joint statement with European leaders on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Rome, Biden has promised that the U.S. will only quit the nuclear deal if Iran breaks its terms. But that has angered hawkish U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. He says Biden has zero constitutional authority to make that pledge. Cruz says that the deal has not been endorsed by the Senate and that any future Republican president will, in his own words, tear it up again. Well, Iran says that Cruz is in fact confessing that the White House administrations are rogue. Elijah Magner is a journalist and political analyst joining us from Brussels. We also have John Stepling, who's an author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. I'd like to welcome you both. Elijah Magner, let me first start with you. So it's an interesting development here in terms of what the U.S. Senator Ted Cruz has said and then Iran's reaction. What do you think about what the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has said when it says that what Senator Cruz has said then shows that the U.S. Administration is rogue?
Well, it's very obvious that Joe Biden is not making up his mind to return to the JCPOA. And is finding all kind of excuses not to comply by the agreement that was revoked by President Donald Trump in 2018. It is up to President Biden, who imposes sanctions as his predecessors did, to remove all the sanctions and to abide by an agreement that was signed and approved by the United States in 2015. This is not very difficult to do if there is a goodwill. However, we've heard already that even the Biden administration is not ready to return to the JCPOA and is not ready to lift all the sanctions, but to return to JCPOA with its own terms, keeping hundreds of other sanctions and imposing a new sanction, as it has been done in the last few days. That indicates already what policy the Biden administration has decided to undertake.
John Stepling, what do you think? Do you think that the Senator Ted Cruz from the U.S., what he has said is indeed factual, that Joe Biden has really no constitutional authority?
I have no idea because I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but it should be borne in mind that Ted Cruz is an extreme charismatic Christian right-wing lunatic, and whether he is technically right or not, the United States could very easily return to the JCPOA. They could very easily lift sanctions. It's not a complicated matter. In 2015, when Iran allowed completely open inspection of all the facilities and so forth, everyone agreed that they were in complete that they were in compliance with all the dictates that had been asked and demanded, and that they were completely open and transparent about everything to do with their nuclear program. And that didn't matter. When Trump got into office, he tore it up. the Republicans will always tear it up. But I think the bigger question here is Averill Haynes, who was Biden's pick for national security, national intelligence, made some comments that were a long way from returning to the JCPOA because of Iran's destabilizing activities in the region, their human rights violations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is just such rank hypocrisy and nakedly, you know, dishonest. I mean, the mind reels. The United States, as an example, has 700 out of every 100,000 members of the populace in prison. It leads the world per capita and in real terms, in terms of prison population. Iran has 228 out of every 100,000. The U.S. is the only nation that has used nuclear weapons, in fact. And it is also a supporter of Israel, who has never signed any agreement and has nuclear weapons. The U.S. continues to, along with NATO, invade, occupy, bomb, destabilize other countries. It engages in illegal interference in foreign elections. It does all of these things all the time. You know, we could spend the next 2 hours outlining the last 40 years of U.S. And CIA covert operations globally. But everybody knows this. So this is just this kind of almost Orwellian doublespeak that comes out of Washington all the time. Do I think they will go back to the JCPOA? No, I don't think they will. I don't see that it gives Biden any sort of political capital to do that, and it would probably be a nuisance for him. Meanwhile, of course, the U.S. economy is falling off a cliff. Because of the vaccine mandate, there are all kinds of problems. 26 New York City firehouses closed. The infrastructure is crumbling. Roads are in terrible disrepair, and unemployment is through the roof. The U.S. has a lot of problems. Meanwhile, Biden flies off to the COP26 dog and pony show with private jets flying in and limousines delivering various billionaires to this conference on climate change. I mean, we're living in a moment of just surreality, I think, and this is just one aspect of it. Iran, of course, has been declared a pariah state by the U.S. It's not invited to any of these things. It's treated as if it's another evil empire, and it has done nothing. I mean, nothing, and any country you pick would pale in comparison to the crimes of the United States, frankly. But they dictate the narrative. They're in control of the narrative in terms of media and so forth. They own and control the media along with these unelected billionaires, and that's what you get. So I don't know what Iran is supposed to do. It's done everything asked of it. As I say, it did it back in 2015. So I think it would be unrealistic, though, for them to expect the U.S. to honor its word or to deal in an open and truthful manner with this.
Well, Elijah Magner, what do you think about some of the actions by the U.S. as Iran is grappling with not only trying to make sure that if and were it to return to the deal, that it needs to be verified in terms of the commitments that the U.S. has, that if the next administration comes, it's not going to tear up the deal. And then you have things like the U.S. sanctioning Iran in this process, or for the U.S. to and its allies to fly the B-1B bombers in West Asia. I'm not sure it's B-1B or B-2B-1. It doesn't matter. These are the jets that they're flying over. And, of course, you know, the use of that is a slogan now. You know, options, other options, et cetera. What kind of signals does that send to Iran? And how should Iran react, do you think?
Well, first of all the bombers and the frigate that the Americans are sending to West Asia, today they are sitting duck to the Iranian missiles, because Iran is no longer today, 2021, as it used to be in 1979-1990 during the Iran-Iraq war. But the situation has changed, and are asking to include the missile program and the armed drones in the JCPOA illegally, because that is not what was negotiated in 2015. So, but saying that all options are on the table, this is a narrative we've been hearing for the last 5 or 6 years since Donald Trump was in power. And to be honest, Joe Biden is not talking about military options, he's talking about diplomatic options, because he knows the limitation today, notwithstanding the almighty power, military power of the U.S., but there are many limits to the use of force against Iran and what Iran is capable to do against the dozens of the military bases spread in West Asia. Secondly, there is no trust with the U.S. because the U.S. was the first to shred the JCPOA in 2018. And not only that, Iran found itself with cement in Iraq nuclear facility, reducing all its production just to meet it and to comply by JCPOA. Why the Americans just refused it and refused to abide by the signature and the commitment they've done with the United Nations and with other European countries and China and Russia. Therefore, it is the right of Iran to start scaling back its compliance in 2019 and continue to do so today and ask for guarantee that it's not going to pour more cement in its nuclear facilities today when the Americans are not showing any good will or positive intention to comply by JCPOA again and to not keep going around it and imposing new conditions or asking the Europeans to talk on their behalf, something completely without any sense. And the Europeans said that to Iran, and I know that from Brussels, that European leaders are saying to the Iranians that we agree with you that the U.S. is the one to be blamed, but we don't have enough leverage against the U.S. to force them back to the table again as we agree in 2015. We just don't have the power to do so.
Thank you very much for that. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And thank you, John Stepling, for your input, author and commentator in Deroy, Norway. And that does it for this segment. Welcome back. COVID infections in Russia are at their peak, and the new wave of the pandemic seems to be nowhere near subsiding. Nearly 1,200 deaths in the past 24 hours alone, setting a new record high. That is the 14th consecutive day that the country is seeing over 1,000 fatalities. The total tally is now above 240,000. There have also been over 39,000 daily infections. The overall caseload is nearing 5.6 million. Russian officials are struggling to contain the surge, imposing a partial lockdown nationwide. Elsewhere in Europe, the Czech Republic is recording its highest daily infections since the end of March, with around 7,600 cases. Taiwan is looking to hone the combat skills of its reserve forces next year by providing them with more extensive military training. According to the Defense Ministry, mandatory refresher training for some reserve troops will be increased to 14 days from about a week at present. The reservists will be required to more than double the number of bullets that they fire in shooting exercises. Also, combat training will be extended to 56 hours from only half a day now. Tensions are at the high between China and Taiwan. Beijing views the island as part of its territory, but Taiwan is seeking independence and says will defend its sovereignty if there's an armed conflict. Beijing is also at odds with Washington over its military exchanges and contacts with Taiwan. Earlier, we spoke with political commentator Fabrizio Goldoni. He believes the U.S. Security Council sanctions against North Korea can be considered as a crime against humanity because they are pushing the general population into an extreme level of hardship.
It's really free of charge. They create a huge human cost and big problems for the food chain and for the life of the common people. So, you know, some people even to say that sanction in this way can be configured as a kind of a crime against humanity.
New developments are emerging in a post-Brexit dispute over fishing rights between London and Paris, with Britain now welcoming what it calls France's decision to step back from its earlier threats. Britain's environment minister says London wants to de-escalate tensions. Just days ago, a French boat was seized after entering waters around the UK. George Eustace says the vessel has now been released. France initially threatened to close its ports to British vessels and impose extra customs checks on UK goods starting midnight Monday. But President Emmanuel Macron is now delaying those sanctions to give talks a chance. The dispute is rooted in certain terms of the Brexit deal. They grant France continued fishing access to British waters even after Brexit. More talks are planned for Thursday. Political commentator Rodney Shakespeare believes the current dispute between Paris and London is about more than just the fishing rights in the English Channel.
You see, if both sides want to resolve this dispute, they can. Essentially, it's about whether French fishing boats in the past have fished and have the evidence. And if each individual boat has the evidence that it has fished in the past, it may apply for a license. But when it doesn't have the evidence, it doesn't get the license. So you see, by discussion on the individual cases of the French fishing boats, you can, if you wish, resolve it. But Macron has an election and so wants a fight against the UK. And the UK, you know, Brexit and all that, wants to show that they're standing up and fighting the French. I would point out that the dispute mechanism is in fact untested, and it relies on arbitration, and if they don't agree, then it's very serious stuff in which the French would actually hold the cards because of all the trade which goes across the Channel and the various ways in which they could cause trouble for the UK.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
One of the important aspects of corruption is the wrongdoing committed in implementing the policies on Article 44. During this time in the judiciary branch, Mr. Raisi pursued many of these wrongdoings, and at that time he delivered a report to me. The policies on Article 44, which could have helped the economy of the country to blossom in the true sense of the word, were implemented in a way that such wrongdoings were allowed to appear. Of course, there are instruments for confronting these wrongdoings, including the information databases that have become legal for a few years. I frequently advised officials to set up these databases and to link them together because it will give the administration a complete control, in the true sense of the word, over the fight against corruption. But this has not been done yet. It has not moved forward. you should endeavour to establish these databases, since they completely enable the government and the administration to have mastery over these affairs.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The issue of reviving people's trust and hope is very important as well, because the people's trust is the greatest investment for the administration. When the people trust you and are hopeful about you, they will get along with you and help you. The greatest investment for the administration is to earn the people's trust, but this has been damaged to some extent, and you should fix this. The way to do this is to harmonize your words and your actions. If you make a promise and fulfill it, the people will trust you. If you make a promise and fail to act on it, or if you claim that something has been accomplished but then the people see that it has not been accomplished, the people's trust will be lost. You should really be careful about this. Mr. Raisi, yesterday you made certain promises to the people of Ahwaz, Khuzestan, and you issued some governmental decrees. You should be careful to seriously follow them up so that the people see that what you want and what you say is realized in practice. These are necessary actions.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The group was formed to address major issues related to global economy. It is composed of world's largest economies, including Brazil, Britain, China, Germany, India, and the US, among others. These member countries account for 80% of the global GDP, 75% of global trade, and 60% of the world population. But the G20 has been criticized for its limited membership, particularly for its underrepresentation of African countries. There are also disputes over the legitimacy of the G20 and criticisms of its organization and its declarations. the group has failed to address its previous promises, like inequality, social justice, poverty, capitalism, and unemployment. Therefore, the summits are often met with protests, especially by anti-globalization groups. This year, the G20 annual summit gathered the international leaders of world's biggest economies for a two-day meeting under the chairmanship of Italy in Rome. The summit was the first in-person meeting in over a year after the 2020 summit was virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Still, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin participated in the summit virtually. The member states addressed several global challenges, such as the pandemic, climate change, spiking energy prices, supply chain disruptions, and so forth. The bloc is under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. These nations account for roughly 80% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. This year's event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment. In fact, wealthy nations such as the US have implemented a Me First policy by stockpiling vaccine doses and offering booster shots, while many poor countries are still waiting to receive their first COVID jabs.
Well, they have failed to end inequality, to end poverty, and to slow and change the trajectory of climate change, because the leaders of these governments simply don't care about those things.
After Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have urged Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, US President Joe Biden, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have called on Iran to, quote, change course. That's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year, but started cutting back on them in response to the US abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it's ready to restart negotiations in late November, but wants to see the verifiable removal of sanctions as an outcome of the talks. Washington, on the other hand, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions on Friday, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement.
They will justify it by saying that Iran wouldn't come back to the bargaining table. They will not look at the fact that it was the United States that withdrew, and the United States that must make the first major move to resurrect this agreement. But this summit is certainly a place where many, many discussions occur, many issues are on the table to be resolved. The situation with U.S. violation of the JCPOA is certainly one of them, but it is being ignored.
Iran has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. Meanwhile, Tehran has time and again stated that its nuclear program is peaceful, and it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran's stance is clear: effective removal of anti-Iran sanctions and the normalization of economic and trade ties with the country. Iran requires guarantees that the other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will not break their promises once again.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced a dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued, but that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup. That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan. The UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to their more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this is why it's important to stress that it is not a given that the UAE, Saudi, and Egypt will support this coup. It's not a given that they are lobbying on behalf of Abdel Fattah Burhan.
But it appears that the Sudanese are determined to continue their protests, as they have done in the past few years, until their demands are met.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Kordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, you know, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is, if any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world, so they really don't understand criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Kordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who is a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, the Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
Iran's capital, Tehran, hosted a meeting on its neighboring country, Afghanistan. The top diplomats of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan have attended the gathering in person, while the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers were present online. The UN chief also sent a message to the summit online.
We need to keep engaging to help move things in the right direction. Force Afghans and the region also need a country that is secure, not one that is a haven for terrorism or a center for drug trafficking. This is vital to peace and stability in the region and around the world. Excellencies, these are all issues on which the region has a shared interest and on which all of us must speak with one voice. We can only achieve more stability with a united approach. Together, let us act with determination and without delay to help the people of Afghanistan and to secure a better future for all.
The conference took place a week after the third meeting of the Moscow Format Consultations on Afghanistan was held in the Russian capital. the Tehran meeting is aimed at stepping up collaborations between Afghanistan's neighboring countries and creating lasting peace there. Iran has always strongly advised against the interference of foreigners in Afghanistan's affairs and respected the country's independence and territorial integrity. It has also urged the formation of an inclusive government in the country.
In Afghanistan, we are facing a situation that in order to reach an acceptable point for all Afghans, we still have a long way ahead of us.
Amir Abdullahian said this is a joint press conference with the visiting Pakistani counterpart, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, in Tehran. He added that Iran was pursuing contacts with all neighbors to Afghanistan to make sure the utmost use of capacities was achieved at its border crossings for trade and humanitarian aid delivery. The United States is a major factor in the current mess in Afghanistan. The U.S. military led the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 in what it proclaimed was a war on terror, meant to eradicate the Taliban. 20 years on, in mid-August this year, the Afghan government and military collapsed in the face of the Taliban's swift advances on the ground, which many attribute to a hasty withdrawal of U.S.-led occupation forces from the country. The UN World Food Program says 3.2 million children under 5 are close to acute malnutrition. Afghanistan is now on the brink of bankruptcy. The U.S. has frozen $10 billion of the country's assets in a bid to bring poor and war-weary Afghans to their knees. The resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group on the back of the U.S. exit has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban-ruled country. It's believed that the presence of Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan perfectly serves the interests of Americans.
Well, yeah, Islamic State has been used by the U.S., as has Al-Qaeda inside Syria. So they use these proxies to destroy the stability of countries.
Afghanistan lies at the crossroads of South and Central Asia. It has been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, which killed scores of people, most of them were Shia worshippers. There are reports that in the months before the U.S.-led coalition forces left the country, thousands of terrorists made their way to Afghanistan from Central Asia, North Caucasus, Pakistan, and China's Xinjiang region. Most of them were recruited by Daesh.
Every indication is that the U.S. will try, which is why this inclusive government is needed to resist such abilities to drive a wedge in society.
These foreign terrorists slipped into the country under the nose of U.S. and NATO forces. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but further fanned its flames.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Wa'ala, ghayru deen Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This program, Islamic Laws, we're going to talk about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the rules, the jurisprudential laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. What are some of the recommended acts to be performed by someone who goes to a mosque? Would you shed some light on these recommended acts?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are a number of recommended acts that mu'minin may perform and they can do to achieve more reward. One important act to do is to clean the mosque, to tidy up the mosque, to make it as clean as possible. And it's when a person sees that the mosque is dirty or there is dust, it is important to dust the mosque, to keep it clean, to keep it tidy. Now this is one good act that every individual can do. And another good act is to, when a person wants to go into a mosque, it is very good and important that one actually wears a clean dress,
yes,
takes a shower, and of course uses fragrance, mm-hmm. uses fragrance, or uses, let's say, perfume, and goes inside the mosque with fragrance. That's another good act that everybody can do. And then it's also said, according to even a riwayat, that when a person walks into the mosque, it is recommended that he walks with the right foot. He places the right foot first into the mosque, and then walks into the moves into the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
This is recommended. And of course, and when he goes out of the mosque, when he steps out of the mosque, he places his left foot out. These are recommended acts. These are some of the recommended acts, you know. And of course, there are also makruh acts, which I will, if necessary, discuss with you.
Yes.
These are something which are recommended. Also, it's, you know, it's good to offer namaz tahiyyat, or the tahiyyat prayer. Mm-hmm. You know, tahiyyat
okay.
prayer is also good to pray.
So, recommended act is to offer two units of tahiyyat prayer, as you yeah. said, right, upon entering a mosque.
Yes.
How is this prayer offered? Is it different from other kinds of prayers?
Well, the difference, you know, there are two rakats of tahiyyat prayer which is recommended to offer. And the tahiyyat prayer is just like morning prayer. The difference is only in the niyyah. You just form your intention that you are going to offer two rakats of tahiyyat prayer. And the name of the prayer is tahiyyat prayer, okay? Tahiyyat means greeting. It means a kind of, let's say, compliment. Compliment. Mm-hmm. And of course, you offer namaz tahiyyat out of respect for the prayer. The whole sole idea behind tahiyyat prayer is to give respect to the mosque, and it does not make any difference whether you enter what mosque you enter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you walk into, let's say, Masjid al-Nabi, the Prophet's mosque in Medina, or Masjid al-Haram, or even your local mosque, because as long as they are mosques, they must be respected. And one way of giving respect is to offer two rakats of tahiyyat prayer. The difference is only in the niyyah. Otherwise, let's say, if you offer two rakats of qaza prayer, again it's sufficient. You know, if you offer two rakats of morning fajr prayer, again it's sufficient as a kind of giving respect to the prayer. And you don't need to offer tahiyyat prayer separately.
Mm-hmm.
So two rakats of prayer, whether it is qaza prayer, whether it's fajr prayer, or whether it is tahiyyat prayer, is sufficient.
Very quickly, Sheikh, is it different from the visitation or ziyarat prayer that again comes in two units, I guess? Like
prayer.
To the imams, the shrines of the imams.
Yeah, two rakats of mustahab prayer, but
yes.
that is not called tahiyyat prayer, okay?
That's different.
That's different because you give, you give a visit to the shrine.
Yes.
To the shrine, and it is actually recommended to offer two rakats of namazi ziyara or the ziyarat prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the niyyah is different. Otherwise, it's the same as fajr prayer, and of course, it is different. Even if you offer two rakats namaz tahiyyah, again, it's recommended to offer two rakats of namazi ziyara because it's part of the ziyarat nama that you actually recite before. Let's say visiting or when you visit.
Mm-hmm.
The
thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our discussion about the laws of mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Don't go away.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting, and my guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the laws